The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 2002, I had a debut novelist come out to the station for an interview. She was on book tour for her novel, Leaving Atlanta. She had written it while she was a graduate student at Arizona State University. Her name is Tayari Jones, and she's originally from Atlanta. And she came out to see us that day, and at the time I thought, what a great debut, and maybe she'll be famous someday. Well, she is now. Last year, she put out a book called An American Marriage. That was her fourth novel, and it was picked by Oprah Winfrey for her book club. And you know what that can do for a novelist. Let's listen now to Tayari Jones from her first interview, recorded back in 2002. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Tayari Jones. Her novel is called Leaving Atlanta. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Is this your first book?
Yes, it is. This is my debut effort, my first time out.
What caused you to want to write a book?
It's the only thing I've ever wanted to do, actually. Only thing I've ever wanted to do was write. When I was in the second grade, I considered being a hairdresser, but in the third grade, I was sold on writing.
It's called Leaving Atlanta. Is that where you're from?
I was born downtown.
And this book is a novel, so it's fiction, so it's not real, but it is very real, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is a fiction, but it's set against the backdrop of an actual historical event. In 1979, when I was about in the fifth grade, there was a serial killer in Atlanta that killed about 30 children over an 18-month period, and that serves as the setting for my novel.
And you're in the book, aren't you?
Yes, I do cameo a bit in there.
When this was going on in Atlanta, what was that like being in fifth grade?
Well, it's really different than most people think. Quite often people say, were you just really scared? But as a kid, children are not as scared as adults because children don't think it's globally. Children, if you're 10 and you have a cousin who's 14 and that cousin is nearby, you feel safe because you have like an honorary adult with you. But I think that the way it felt in Atlanta at that time really differed from child to child because if you don't know, if the terror is faceless, the face you put on it comes from your own life and your own experience. And what I most remember is that our parents were very protective of us because a child was disappearing about every other week. And the closest thing that I can give you that to approximate the tension, it's kind of like the way that it was right after September 11th when everyone was questioning things that they thought were secure before, just the kind of idea that something unthinkable had happened and we were forced to cope with it.
I remember this time. I can remember looking at the papers and hearing about this homicidal maniac, and they didn't know who this person was, and then they supposedly solved it, and they caught this guy, and everything was fine.
Well, it's true that in 1981, Wayne Williams was tried for the killing of two adults, but it was assumed that he was being tried for what was known as the Atlanta Child Murders. And that's a kind of strange question on was everything okay? It depends. I mean, there are quite a lot of theories that thrive in Atlanta, particularly in Southwest Atlanta, as to whether or not he really did it or didn't do it, or if he was framed, or if this was some way of the city government trying to make things okay because they were trying to make Atlanta the convention center hub of the South at the time. So I almost think that the reaction to it is almost as interesting as the case itself.
Did the murders stop after Wayne Williams got locked up?
It's one of those things, depends on who you ask, because since the victims of the murders were largely very disenfranchised people, poor children from Atlanta's Southwest Side for the most part, people say that some people will tell you that the murders continue, but because these children didn't count, if you will, that it wasn't made public. So it's unclear. Officially, yes, it's over, but there's still quite a lot of murmurings in the city.
Is the subtext to that that if you're a rich little kid from the suburbs and you disappear, like we've been reading lately, this has been going on a lot out in places like California, it gets a lot more attention from the media?
Well, certainly. I think that the media does tend to favor the disappearances of rich children. I think they're valued more, and I also think that their lives are more photogenic to show a big house and say, this family, they have everything, but they've lost their child, as opposed to a family who has nothing and they've lost their child.
Your book, Leaving Atlanta, looks at three young people in Atlanta growing up on the Southwest Side, and each of these kids has sort of a troubled life. You want to tell us about these three kids and where they came from? Are they composites? Who are these kids?
They are, I don't know if they're necessarily composites. They're largely figments of my imagination, but they were all, each of their creation was sparked by something in my own life. The first story in the book is called Magic Words, and the main character is Tasha, who's a middle-class girl who, her parents are divorcing, and her father comes back when he realizes that the children are in danger. Because of the murders, he's motivated to return to his family. And then, so almost as a middle-class girl, she's almost like kind of a beneficiary to this horrible event. Her life improves because of that. And I think that her lesson, which is what I was trying to do, where the murders meant something different to each child, and her lesson is that what class really means, she learns as a result of these murders, because before the murders, who was rich or who had money and who didn't, as far as children even know, was a matter of what kind of shoes you wore. But in 1979, it became a matter of life and death. The second child in the book is Rodney, who's very introverted, and his father is a self-made man who brags about being his own boss. And he's kind of old school, and he thinks that he can discipline his children into becoming the kind of people he wants them to be. And for Rodney, the fear takes the face of what he knows. He wonders if it's his own father, because a policeman has told us, if you don't know who it is, you don't know who it's not. And since his father is so central to his life, he thinks, could it be my dad? And the final story is narrated by Octavia, who is teased by all the children. They call her mean names, and they have cruelly nicknamed her the Watusi because of the way she looks. And her story is called Sweet Pea, because that's how she's known at home. And she lives very close to the scene of the crime. She doesn't live in the projects, as she's quick to tell you. She lives across the street from the projects. But she narrates the way the story looks from where she lives.
And Tasha, she is laboring with the stigma in the early part of the story of her parents separating. And we get into that world of gossip of grade school kids saying hurtful things about one another, and she really wants people to like her, and she really wants to be loved and feel secure. And a young man befriends her and shows interest in her. And her father says, that kid won't make it to be 18, and warns her about this kid. And then he disappears. There's something very ominous behind all this.
Well, it was the way that it was in 1979. I mean, it isn't at all uncommon for fathers to be protective of their daughters. Your daughter's 12 and she's talking to a boy, looks like he might be 14, you know, and to say, you know, stay away from that boy. He's a bad boy. But as the father said, I used to be a boy once myself, so I know what I'm talking about. But in 1979, things were different. But people's attitudes hadn't caught up with the reality that this boy might not live to be 18. And also, I also want to look at the fact that he might not have anyway, because life is dangerous for certain children anyway. So the father's pronouncement came true in a quick way because of the year, but it may have been waiting there lurking, you know, as the boy grew older.
There's something very, very interesting to me as the reader. This young man who befriends Tasha, he's sort of an entrepreneur, and he's got his little business where he's selling those air fresheners, those little pine trees that
yes.
you see hanging off the mirror.
Yes.
And you use that as sort of a scary little thing in the book. You're good.
Well, thank you. You're the first person to notice my Christmas tree ornaments, those little Christmas things hanging from the from the windshield. I use that because one of the children actually was selling, it wasn't Christmas trees, but it was candy bars, I think, in a parking lot when he was last seen. Many of these kids who disappeared were doing little things to help support their families. Their mothers worked, they weren't well supervised, and they were out, they may have been 13, 14, 9, to try to help their families. And I put one of those Christmas trees in every story from then out, just as a little reminder, a kind of talisman of what has happened throughout.
Nobody else picked up on that?
Not yet.
Well, I used to work in a record store. In fact, during the period that this was happening, I managed a record store. And customers used to come in now and then and ask us if we sold those. They wanted them. They wanted those little air fresheners.
They were really popular in the late 70s.
They were. You're right. And it clicked with me. And I thought, yeah, this kid, he's sharp. He's selling these things. And then at the end of the second story, we see one hanging off of the mirror. Ooh.
Well, thank you. I like those, too, because they're so familiar that it kind of make, if they're kind of a symbol of the danger and it's something that's so familiar that it would kind of give you a feel for how it was everywhere, how danger was as prevalent as those little Christmas trees hanging from people's rearview mirrors.
Plus, there's the juxtaposition between artificially scenting the air to make it smell good when you've got this decomposition thing going on throughout the book.
Very good.
My guess is Tayari Jones. The book is Leaving Atlanta. What was the process like for you to write this book?
Well, I was very fortunate to be enrolled in an MFA program at the time, Master of Fine Arts at Arizona State University. By chance, I ran into the director of the program, and she said, move to Arizona and work with me. I'll be your mentor. And so I moved out there, despite the fact that everyone was saying, you can't move to Arizona. It's so hot, and they don't have the King holiday. But I moved out there anyway, and they do have the King holiday, by the way. And I worked on it for about 2 hours a day, every day, because I felt so fortunate to have this scholarship to study writing. And I just worked for, I figured 2 hours a day for 2 years equals a book. And I worked on, I had classes, you know, where you give it to people to get their opinions, which isn't such a great idea, I don't think. But I just knew that I wanted to document my childhood. And I had that guiding me as I worked, that this is a story that needed to be told. And I just, it's like a lot of grunt work. It's not magical. Sometimes writers have these things like, oh, my characters speak to me. They do this. I sat down every day with my computer and worked for 2 hours a day.
So Tasha didn't say, I'm going to do this right now?
No, she didn't say, I think I need a new coat. No. It's not that kind of process for me. It's not mystical at all for me.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO with my 2002 interview with Tayari Jones. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And this was my first and only interview with Tayari Jones. And as she told me at the end of this conversation, it was her first live radio interview. We'll bring you more of it right after this.
The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library and the Washington Centerville Public Library.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO and my 2002 interview with the novelist Tayari Jones, talking about her debut novel. All of these kids have a sadness to them, and Tasha's dad comes back into her life, which is something that she dearly wants. She's got a little sister who also wants that. The marriage is somehow reconstituted as a result of the fear. So you pointed out earlier that this is a good thing. Rodney has a dad, but this is a huge problem in his life. And we think of the father as being that protective figure. Yet, of all the kids, he's the one that really isn't protected.
Yes, his father ironically tries to protect him and gives him these little speeches as to why he does the things he does. His father is a violent man, but he's not kind of a off-the-cuff violent man. He's very calculated. He explains, you know, I'm going to have to beat you because, and gives him some little riff about his own childhood. So you understand that he's a very deliberate and thoughtful man. He's just completely off track and doesn't understand his child at all. And what is in Rodney's section? It says, you've heard of an epidemic of disappearing black fathers, but you could never be as lucky. That's how Rodney feels about his father, because the man, I think Rodney kind of goes beyond the point where kind of like people like, oh, you know, he should be lucky he has a father. He should be lucky he has a two-parent family. But his two parents don't understand him.
And then we have the third story about, is it Octavia?
Octavia.
I think that as a reader, we really connect with her. We really like her. We want her to do well. And she certainly doesn't have a dad. She's probably in the worst condition of any of them.
She's in the worst material position than all of them. Mm-hmm. But in some other ways, she's in a very good position. It's just her and her mom. She doesn't have any sibling rivalry to worry about. And her mother loves her very much. And she knows this, I think, even though she doubts. But she has a fairly secure environment in some ways. But the interesting thing about her is that she is the child who is least liked at school. And she is probably in the most physical danger because of where she lives. But she has the most to say. She's probably more insightful than the other two.
And they all know each other.
Yeah, they're all in the same fifth grade class.
We have the scene in the first book, in the first story, where Tasha goes into the kitchen and realizes her mother has a television set up in the kitchen, which is something that she'd been told many times, we'll never get a TV in the kitchen. And this is when it first appears on the news about these kids, and they have the photos of the kids that are missing, and everything has changed. It's a different landscape all of a sudden. Her mom is repeating things that her dad used to say. Her rules, everything are topsy-turvy. Suddenly there's a TV in the kitchen. Suddenly we see kids that we know turning up on the television. You lived through this time. What was that like?
Well, I do remember the television being so central, and I had kind of, you know, it was the late 70s, the kind of parents who's like, children shouldn't watch much television, children should be independent, et cetera, you know, free thinkers. But we were all glued to the television during this time. Everything did change, and to get more information and to find out, I was always watching, because I was a child, to look out to see if I recognized anyone on the news. And what I remember as much as seeing a couple of kids that I knew on the news was when they started finding the bodies. They found one of the bodies very near to my house in a place I had never heard of, within 5 miles of my house, and I had never heard of it. So I felt like there was this person out there who knew my neighborhood better than I did. And that person, you know, had malicious intent. Two of the children who were murdered went to my elementary school, and I recognized them when they came on the news. One was a very quiet, smart boy by the name of Yusef Bell, and his mother became instrumental in the mother's movement. But the other boy was named Terry Pugh, and his murder was deemed to be unrelated, even though he was murdered, you know, the right demographic. And he was a very scary boy. He was older than all of us. He rode a motorcycle. He came to school like twice a month and harassed us little kids to death. And when he disappeared, we felt like, oh my, he is the baddest child ever. If someone can kill him, we're done.
And I can see that at least one of these characters has a little bit of him in the character in the book. At least one. Am I right about that?
Well, I did think about that as this, although my character in my book is a lot more lovable than this boy was that we knew. But it's just kind of like with writing. You get like a little germ of idea, the idea of a kid who's older than the other kids, and then it goes so far from your actual observation, just like the little germ remains.
What's the response been like back home in Atlanta?
Well, things have been real. I get emails every day from people. Sometimes people email me to quibble with things like, there was no stoplight on that corner, you know. But sometimes I get lots of messages from people saying that they've never recognized their childhood in a book before. And so it's been just lovely. I had a wonderful book party at my alma mater, Spelman College, and so many people came out. It's been lovely. I've gotten great press. The book was reviewed in People, which is rare for a first book. I just feel so fortunate with this project. I feel like like the universe is collaborating with me to help get this story out.
Would it have been more difficult for you to write this book if you hadn't ever left Atlanta? Was it good to get away?
Oh, definitely, because Atlanta is changing so much that you can't even remember what it used to be like. For example, the children's bodies were being found in deserted places, but these deserted places are now built up. So it's hard to imagine. Like, sometimes I tell people, they found the bodies way out on Panola Road, which was nowhere when I was a kid. And now they say things like, oh, really, over there by that Home Depot? So to live there, I wouldn't be able to remember the landscape at all.
Where is Wayne Williams now?
He's in jail. He was served with a double term of life imprisonment. He's about 45 now. He was only 22 when he was arrested. And when I was a child, he seemed like such an adult. But now I'm like, oh, he was just a whippersnapper living at home.
So do you really think that this killer is still out there somewhere?
I'm unsure. I know that the case against Wayne Williams is very strange, and these murders were just very strange. Sometimes you wonder if maybe perhaps it wasn't all just one serial killer, if children in this certain demographic are not in great peril anyway. So I'm not sure, but I don't feel like the children are safe.
Well, and I think that includes, obviously, all kinds of children. And we have that terrible thing, a very rich little girl in Boulder, Colorado, and the police totally messed up the evidence, and the parents are very affluent, and some people think that the mother did it. And
well, people always, it's such a painful thing. People always say that, you know, the parents, your parents are the most likely people to murder a child, statistically. But it's so painful for a family who didn't murder their child, you know, to be under this, to mourn and be under suspicion at the same time. It's a very, that happened in Atlanta as well. There was a lot of suspicion cast upon the families of the children. And it was just a very painful, difficult time.
And we live in an era where mothers work a lot. I can remember growing up and the thought of a mother working. I'm old enough to remember that mothers didn't work when I was a kid, and we didn't really have latchkey kids. Tasha's very proud of the fact that she has a key around her neck and that she can go home and be the boss of her little sister for 2 hours before her mother comes home. We have all these latchkey kids.
Yes, we do. But also for certain children in certain demographics, like for poor women have always worked, like the women who worked as domestics and women who worked as factories, they had children, and their children have been alone historically. But for Tasha, as a middle-class child with a working mother, is different. And she's home alone, but she's largely supervised. You know, this idea of this latch key. Before the murder, she would come home, lock the door, and be proud that she was, you know, the queen of the thermostat. She could turn it up 2 degrees, and that was that. But I think that the children who are unsupervised are in peril in a way that they are not when they are supervised.
How'd you get a book deal?
Well, I was so fortunate. As I said, I went to Arizona to work with Jewel Parker Rhodes, who I met, who said moved to Arizona and worked with me. She introduced me to her agent, who called me with a very gravelly voice one day, and the lady said to me, "Hi, Tiari, this is Jane Distel. It's not a slam dunk, but I think I can sell it for you." And I said, "Oh, yes, ma'am. Thank you, because I'm from the South and she's from New York. And then about 6 months later, she told me that she had signed me up with Time Warner. And I started behaving like I had just won a game show, and just screaming and jumping up and down and all this. I've just been so lucky. I meet people all the time who volunteer to help me with the writing and also with what do you do once you have the book out? What's the best way to handle yourself? What's the way to get the next book done? I work with Ron Carlson in Arizona, and he is a brilliant writing instructor.
And Hurston is a name that sadly is not as well known as it should be. She wrote some amazing things, Zora Neale Hurston, and a book came out last year that was a collection of things that had never been published, and we had her, I think it was her grandniece on the program. I think her name's Lucy?
Yes.
And is there any connection in your mind between her work and your work?
Well, she is the master of catching exactly the way that people speak. And if you want to learn how to get the words from the way they sound, to get them down on the page, you must read Zora Neale Hurston. And I really am influenced by her, particularly when I write certain kinds of Southern vernacular.
What are some of the other books or authors that have had an impact on you?
I was greatly influenced by a novel by Jim Grimsley called Winter Birds that's written in the second person. It's the saddest book I've ever read. It broke my heart, but in a good way. As I was working on that book, the fact that he used the second person was useful, and the fact that he was able to publish it was inspiring because it's really a very eccentric point of view to take. And also, like everyone, I am a complete fan of Toni Morrison. When I was 19, I won a writing contest, and I got to meet her, and I was so petrified I didn't say anything to her. I just kind of looked at her and watched her eat because we were having brunch. And also Alice Walker, who went to Spelman, she wrote about her home. That impressed me, that I could perhaps write about my Georgia home, even though I'm an urban Southerner, which people think is an oxymoron.
We had Alice's daughter on this program last year.
Oh, yes. She was everywhere. I read her book. It was very good.
She's got that memoir. It's hard being a famous person.
Is it? I wouldn't know.
Well, you know. I mean, just reading that book and reading her perspective of her mother.
Well, you know, too, it's hard being alive. It's just complicated to be in a family. It's complicated to have a mother. And I think that we each have our own struggles. Someone once said to me once, be kind to everyone you meet, for each is embroiled in a great battle.
That's good. I hadn't heard that one. So do you follow that?
I try to. Well, I know I'm in a battle myself, but I try to. I try to look at each person and know that we each have our own confusion. And I just hope we can sort it out.
So, Tayari, you become famous. Is that going to be difficult for you?
Well, writers only get so famous. Even when they get famous, people don't recognize you when they see you. You know, I could be sitting at a McDonald's next to Stephen King, and I wouldn't know it. So you're only, as a writer, I think you're only as famous as you want to be, so you can manage it yourself.
He'd probably say, aren't you Tayari Jones?
And I would deny it.
The book is Leaving Atlanta. Tayari Jones wrote it. So you're 100 pages into your next book. That's pretty good. Is it going to be a little longer?
I imagine it'll probably be about, I'm imagining, I think I'm a third of the way through it. I worked on it at a wonderful writing colony in upstate New York this summer. It was wonderful. It was called the Ledig House. It was an international writing colony. And I met writers from all over the world. It was so wonderful, particularly post-September 11th, to meet people from all over the world so the rest of the world wouldn't be such a strange place.
How did you get that gig?
One day I was just leisurely surfing the web, and I saw this picture of this place. It was like writing colonies, and I clicked on it, and the deadline was 2 days away. So I scrambled together to get my application, and I just mailed it in, and then they wrote me and said, congratulations, we'd like you to spend 2 months living, you know, at this colony. And I was nervous because I was like, those people might be crazy. You know, what are they going to do with me? But I decided that since I was accepted, I followed through, and when I drove up, I said to my brother, I'm a little apprehensive. And he said, as well you should be. But it turned out to be just a lovely experience.
Is this one of these deals where they basically subsidize your being there?
Yeah, you show. All you have to do is you get there. And once you get there, you live in a wonderful loft studio kind of situation. And they provide the meals and everything. And you just do your thing and meet people.
So if I go online, I can find some stuff like that?
There are lots of places. All you need to do is search for writing colonies.
Are you an internet person?
Oh, am I? Yes. I made my own web page. When I found out how much it would cost to have one made, I made it myself because I said, there are too many web pages out there. If it's that complicated, so many people wouldn't have them.
I don't see your website.
Well, it's www.tayarijones.com, of course.
Okay, and that's Tayari Jones, like you would expect, .com.
Yes.
Tayari. We have a lot of listeners out there who are online right now, and right now they're trying to spell your first name.
It is phonetically correct.
What do you do when you're online? What kind of stuff? Are you going to search engines? Or are you going to eBay and buying things?
I do go to eBay. I do. You can buy anything. I was able to buy a mug that I had as a child because I wouldn't share with my brother and I felt guilty. And so on my 30th birthday, I mailed him a mug exactly like the one, $3. plus a dollar shipping. You can't beat that. But I go to eBay, I go to Amazon.com, I go to Half.com and purchase all manner of junk. And I also like to search for other authors' websites. I do, when I get bored or anxious, I'm online. I even go to that weird site, bored.com, and do the virtual bubble wrap. You click on the bubble wrap, and it's like you're popping it with your fingers.
Bored.com?
Bored, yes. There's all kinds of stuff to do on bored.com. B-O-R-E-D.
So you're popping bubble wrap bubbles in cyberspace?
Yes, you do it with your mouse. Click, click, click.
Does it sound like a bubble?
It's just like you're popping the bubble wrap. I highly recommend the virtual bubble wrap.
I hadn't heard that one. Wow.
Well, don't go tell everyone. They'll overload the server.
Well, you're really fun, and I really think your book is wonderful, and I recommend it to our readers out there.
Well, thanks. And I've had a great time being on your show. This is my first live radio show.
No way.
Yeah, I've done taped stuff, but this is my first. It's been great. I was a little nervous. I didn't tell you because I didn't want to make you nervous.
You were nervous? I couldn't tell. In fact, since you've admitted that you were a radio virgin, we're going to prolong the pleasure or the agony by asking you another question.
I'm ready.
What question have I not asked you that you'd love to answer?
Oh, now, see, that's almost unfair. I think that a really good question to ask me is, I don't know. I think you're so thorough. You're such an excellent host. I can't think of anything else. You can ask me why I chose the title I chose.
The book is called Leaving Atlanta. Now, why on earth would Tyari Jones choose that title?
Well, of course, you know, there is a character who literally leaves, but I was kind of looking at Atlanta as a sort of metaphoric place. In 1979, it was like supposed to be like the Black Promised Land because we had a Black mayor, Black school board president, Black police chief, the only city in the country that could boast that, and people kind of idealized it. And I look at the murders as a kind of post-civil rights wake-up call type situation, and people had to leave that kind of utopic vision of Atlanta. And also it was 1980, and when the murders were over, Reagan was president. Our hometown president, Jimmy Carter, had been sent home with his tail between his legs.
This has been her first live radio interview. Now, don't be disappointed if your next one isn't this much fun.
I'll try not to be.
I'm trying to warn you. I'm trying to help you here.
Well, I'm just very pleased, and I love NPR.
Well, we love books. And we love people that read books.
And I'm a contributor to my local NPR station.
Good for you. Now, which NPR station do you listen to?
I listen to KJAZZ and 98.1 in Arizona, Tempe, Arizona.
And I'm going to guess they play a lot of jazz.
They do at night, but they have programming all day. I don't have a television, so I listen to I get up in the morning with Morning Edition, and I listen all the way through Marketplace.
You are hardcore.
I am. I don't play around when it comes to my NPR.
That was Tyari Jones, recorded in 2002. I loved it when she said she loved listening to her NPR station all day long. And that was her first live radio show. And you heard me say to her, "It's hard being a famous person." And she said, "Is it? I wouldn't know." Well, I think she must know now, because she's become a best-selling author since we did that interview 17 years ago. Her most recent novel was an Oprah's Book Club pick. It came out last year. She's only put out 4 novels in 17 years, so she takes a while to write her stories. And that most recent one, An American Marriage, is about an African-American couple whose lives are shaken when the husband is arrested for a crime he did not commit. And it's already being turned into a movie. That's Tyari Jones, who's done very well for herself. And we'll bring you a special Book Nook bonus, Best of the Book Nook, right after this.
The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Wright Memorial Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and Micro Sun Lamps.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 1997, I interviewed a writer named Iris Chang. She had just published a book called The Rape of Nanking, The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II. Let's listen now to Iris Chang. My guest is Iris Chang. The book is The Rape of Nanking. Iris, whenever we hear the word Holocaust in association with World War II, it always focuses on the acts of the Germans. And yet, in your book, you state that the Japanese military killed 19 million Chinese during World War II. Why has this information been suppressed?
Well, I think that Cold War politics has really played a great role in the neglect of this history. After World War II, after 1949, the People's Republic of China and the Republic of China in Taiwan, I think, both needed Japan as an ally against each other. And so for economic and political reasons, they did not demand that Japan apologize, nor did they demand that Japan pay the enormous reparations which they owed to her victims. And even the United States turned her former ally of Japan into former enemy of Japan into an ally because the U.S. needed Japan to counter the forces of communism in the Soviet Union and in the PRC. So that's one reason. I think another reason is demographics, that not until recently did we have a number of more Chinese-American writers who possess the English language skills to write such a book.
In your book, you found a direct link between this circumstance and the imperial court of Japan, Emperor Hirohito and his relatives.
That's correct. You see, Prince Asaka, who was Emperor Hirohito's uncle, took command of the armies around Nanking, and it was under his command that a kill-all-captives order was forged, which resulted in the death of tens of thousands of Chinese men. Later, a military intelligence officer under Asaka claimed that it was he who had initiated the order, and that he did it because he didn't want to feed the captives, and he wanted to seek revenge for all the Japanese soldiers who died fighting on their way to Nanking. But even if that's the case, Prince Asaka could have court-martialed the officer, and if the imperial family truly wanted to punish the perpetrators, they would have done so. But instead, Hirohito rewarded his uncle and some other top commanders who had presided over the rape of Nanking, invited them to his palace and gave them out trophies. And so it's clear to me that the royal family was involved, and they escaped all responsibility for this massacre. After the war, none of them faced prosecution during the Tokyo War Crimes trial. The United States saw to it that they were exonerated, and they would not even be called in to testify as witnesses, let alone be prosecuted.
My guest is Iris Chang, and the book is The Rape of Nanking, The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II. Iris, you do find some heroes in your book, some Westerners and others who helped to create a safe zone. If not for this zone, it seems apparent that the entire population could have been exterminated.
That's correct. Yes. At the time, there were some 20 foreigners, most of them Americans, but some also German, Russian, Danish, who decided to stay in Nanking when thousands of other foreigners and Chinese were evacuating the city in November. And they decided to create a safety zone in the center of the city, which was about 2.5 square miles, bordered by Red Cross flags, that would be used to house refugees temporarily when the city fell. Now, none of them had suspected that there would be a massacre. In fact, they thought that most of the trouble would be caused by Chinese soldiers as they retreated from the city, or Chinese looters. So they thought that they would open some camps up for a few days, and then they'd close them down after the Japanese took over, and then there would be peace and harmony. Now, what happened instead is that when the Japanese came into the city, they began a systematic cold slaughter of tens of thousands of men, and then afterwards they began an orgy of rape and torture, and they burned down almost actually more than a third of the city. And so this zone became the only place of refuge for hundreds of thousands of civilians. And in the end, more than, I think, 300,000 civilians sought shelter there. And the place was so packed that some had to stand for days before new camps could be opened so they could actually find a place to sleep.
I found a parallel in the story with the Germanic notion that they were a superior people racially. We have that same feeling in the Japanese military forces, who were dehumanized during their training but felt superior to the Chinese. They felt that the Chinese had no significance as human beings whatsoever.
Subhuman. Yes, I mean, you see this repeatedly in Japanese military diaries. They called the Chinese pigs or ants or sheep. And the Japanese soldiers had been systematically inculcated for violence. They were numbed out, desensitized to torture, and they were often ordered to participate in bayonet practice on live prisoners or decapitation contests so that they would get used to killing. And within a few weeks, many of these young boys became hardened, cold serial killers. It's very frightening to see how fast it happened. And that was what I was trying to do. I was trying to penetrate the mind of the soldiers. And that was the hardest thing to understand, because I don't see how any human being could be capable of committing such atrocities, and yet they do, and it happens again and again. And I remember corresponding with one soldier, a Japanese soldier who had been in Nanking, and he had kept a diary of the event. And I said, why was it so brutal? How could you take life so easily? And he said, we found it easy to kill Chinese lives because we didn't even value our own lives. He said, we had been taught to believe that the emperor was a living god, and that next to him, all human life was valueless, even Japanese life, and that the greatest honor for Japanese soldiers was to come home dead. And he said that we were taught that loyalty was heavy as a mountain, but our own lives were as light as a feather. And so I began to understand how they could have been thrust in this mindset to rape, murder, and torture.
The book is The Rape of Nanking, The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II. Iris Chang has joined us. Iris, if we were to peruse a current Japanese history book, what would it say about the Rape of Nanking?
There might be nothing in there at all, or if there is something, there might be one sentence in the textbook, especially if it's a high school textbook, about something about in 1937 the Nanking incident occurred, period, something like that. It's a terrible thing, but the Japanese Ministry of Education has systematically whitewashed this entire event and other Japanese atrocities from their textbooks. And it's frightening, because if Japanese school children do not learn what happened during World War II, then there's no guarantee that something like this won't happen again. And unlike Germany, which has mandated the teaching of the Holocaust in schools, and it is illegal not to teach the history of the Holocaust in German schools, in Japan, not only is it not well taught, but the government has impeded the efforts of scholars to include this in their textbooks. Now, this has been the basis of a 30-year lawsuit between Naga Saburo, who is a Japanese historian and textbook author, and the Japanese government. And just a few months ago, he won a partial victory in the Japanese Supreme Court. They ruled that the Ministry of Education had overstepped their bounds in censoring his particular textbooks, but they still held on to the right to censor textbooks in the future. And I find this highly alarming, and I think that is the most important thing that I think needs to be changed. I mean, an apology would be nice, and reparations are extremely important, but the truth has to be communicated to the Japanese people.
My guest is Iris Chang. The book is The Rape of Nanking. Iris, as you did the research for the book, it must have been extraordinarily painful for you.
Oh, goodness. It was excruciatingly difficult. I'm telling you, I sometimes had to read 20 or 30 or 50 atrocity stories a day in the beginning. And in the process, I noticed that my hair started to fall out, and I had often, after reading all these stories, I just had no appetite. So I lost a lot of weight, and I remember I would get sick more easily than other people, and it was a terrible situation. And you know what? I think it affected people around me even more. For instance, when my editor got the manuscript and she started working on it, she said the first day she read it, she felt a tremendous heaviness in her chest, and then she had to go home early because I think she was sick. And then she eventually became so ill, she thought she would have to be hospitalized. And it was just a terrible, terrible situation for her. She ended up losing 10 pounds just editing my book alone. And when we were sending out the book for blurbs from famous authors and scholars, Nian Chen, who's the author of Life and Death in Shanghai, a very strong woman who has just seen just about everything there is to see, whose only child had been killed during the Cultural Revolution, and a woman who had spent 8.5 years, I think, in solitary confinement during the Cultural Revolution, when she read my book, she said she had to put it down several times because it was too hard for her to even handle it.
My guest is Iris Chang. The book is The Rape of Nanking. You're commended for writing this book, Iris.
And, thank you so much.
Also for finding out what happened to the heroic Nazi from Nanking and how he went back to Germany and the Gestapo pretty much shut him down. That was not known until your book.
That's right. Yes, indeed. It's one of the great ironies of the story that the head of the International Safety Zone Committee in Nanking, which saved hundreds of thousands of lives, was also the head of the local Nazi Party. Never in a million years I never thought that when I researched this book that I would encounter Nazis at all. In fact, I was even surprised to find that there were Western foreigners in the city as this happened. And I'm glad that there were, because they left a rich record in English, diaries and letters during the massacre. But John Rabe, who was a Siemens businessman and the head of the local Nazi party, he saved hundreds of thousands of lives by being the leader of the Safety Zone Committee. And he kept a 2,000-page diary of the event. And the world didn't know about this until I started tracking down his descendants and found out about it. So this was... When the diary came out, this made the entire third page of the New York Times. Actually, it was pretty big news. And I mean, just a few days ago, Nightline did a segment on it. They interviewed me, as well as John Rabe's granddaughter Ursula Reinhardt and other scholars.
My guest has been Iris Chang. The book is The Rape of Nanking. I know you need to run to your interview with the Chicago Tribune. Thank you so much, Iris.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was my 1997 interview with Iris Chang for her book, The Rape of Nanking, The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II. And that book, I felt, was so important that we had her back on for the paperback. So I did two interviews with Iris for that book. And it also marked something which I had forgotten when we went back and digitized that interview. I was listening to it, and at the end of the interview, I played a piece of music which I thought was very representative of what we've been talking about. And it was the theme to the movie soundtrack, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And that was the first time I played that piece of music associated with the Book Nook. That is our theme that we've used for years. And that was when I really decided that I needed to use that piece of music for a theme. So thank you, Iris, for that. And Iris really experienced some terrible things related to that book. She was quite controversial. A lot of people did not like the book. A lot of people disagreed with it. She was harassed. In 2004, she suffered a nervous breakdown, which her family, friends, and doctors attributed in part to constant sleep deprivation, dozens of herbal supplements, and heavy doses of psychologically damaging prescription medicine. At the time, she was several months into research for her fourth book, about the Bataan Death March. While en route to Harrodsburg, Kentucky, where she planned to gain access to a time capsule of audio recordings from servicemen, she suffered an extreme bout of depression that left her unable to leave her hotel room in Louisville. She ended up going into what was diagnosed as reactive psychosis, and shortly thereafter, Iris Chang took her own life. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis, and the book again was The Rape of Nanking by Iris Chang.